Welcome. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It's the 18th of October, 2012. And today we're joined on the line once again in from Switzerland by our friend David L. Smith of the Geneva Business Insider blog at genevabusinessinsider.blogspot.com. And for those who haven't caught our previous conversations with David Smith, he is a British-Swiss dual national who has a law degree and is a chartered accountant qualification. He has worked in management, finance, private equity, startups, business development. He has experience at major Swiss and U.S. multinationals. He's a fount of information on matters economic, and he is positioned there in the heart of Europe and on the periphery of the Eurozone. So a very important and independent perspective, as always. And so I'm looking forward to this conversation. David Smith, thank you once again for your time.
It's a pleasure to be with you once again. Thank you very much.
Well, I wanted to start off today by talking about an interesting post that you have up on the Geneva Business Insider blogspot where you were talking about currency wars. And this is the idea of the quantitative easing that's happening all around the globe that we were talking about in our previous conversation from the European Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, the Bank of England, the Bank of Japan, and other places besides, which we all know is starting to lower the value of these currencies. And it can seem counterintuitive for people who aren't financially aware of why a country would be interested in devaluing their own currency. It seems like it would put the country in a weaker position, but perhaps not. And you paint this case in a very lucid manner in your post. So let's talk about this currency war, this trade war by proxy that's currently going on with this quantitative easing.
Yes, exactly. We've been seeing now for a prolonged period of time quantitative easing, which sounds wonderfully technical, the kind of phrase which bankers and economists love, designed specifically to lead people up the wrong path, but it actually amounts to nothing more than hitting a print button on a computer and generating money and generating zeros behind the existing money. This has been the preferred tool over a prolonged period of time, and so far, the conclusion of all this has not necessarily been completely evident, but I think we have now reached a stage where we can conclude that this quantitative easing will go on forever. Now, if we go around the world at the moment, we're seeing that Japan is indulging in quantitative easing, China is doing the same thing. Then we come to Europe, where there has been something of a break. In the US, it has been going on for a long time, since the time of TARP onwards. And all of these things are designed basically to lower the exchange rate of a particular currency against other currencies. If we look at the situation of a private citizen, this is extremely detrimental to many. The person who's been saving money all his life, effectively, if he has $1 million in the bank, used to be able to go out and buy a certain number of assets. Now what is happening is if someone prints up twice the number of dollars, is that the purchasing power of that dollar for the assets on the world, which remain essentially the same, falls in half. So it is a hidden tax for the saver, and it is a means of destroying liabilities, such as liabilities towards, for example, with America's case, the Chinese with their bonds. But one thing that is cited very often is that the Chinese are the biggest holders of American bonds. Now, this is an interesting publicity stunt where there is maybe $1 or $1.5 trillion owned by the Chinese, but there are $15 trillion of bonds outstanding. So the question then is, who owns the other 90% that nobody ever talks about? Well, of course, the answer is simple. It's American pension funds, mutual funds, etc. So for people who are sitting in any particular country thinking, oh my goodness, this is really going to give the Chinese a hard time, the answer is it's going to give themselves a time which is 10 times harder than anything the Japanese.
And just as a point of fact, I believe it was last year that the Federal Reserve itself overtook the Chinese as the single largest bondholder of U.S. bonds. So in fact, that Chinese statistic isn't even valid anymore.
This is absolutely true. The Federal Reserve has overtaken the Chinese by a very large margin, and they have done it by the printed money that they're creating out of thin air. So if you actually look at the bonds that they're buying, they are buying bonds with doing nothing more than hitting a print button, as I said once before, on a computer. So the reality of it is that there's nothing to back up these bonds at all. And there has been an arrangement, in fact, made between the Fed and the US government that if one day there is ever a problem, that the Fed can put these bonds back on the American people. Now this is the ultimate definition of a Ponzi scheme. And right in the center of it is the very institution that people have relied on, theoretically, for almost the last 100 years to provide financial stability, interest rate stability, and inflation stability. So
now, to be clear, just to provide the other side of this argument, although it is, of course, detrimental to the average individual saver, it is a boon, as you say, to the people who are holding the liability for the government debt. So obviously the governments themselves actually gain from this because their debts can be diminished by the devaluation of the currency. Also, exporters would tend to gain from this because their exports would become more competitive in the international market.
Yeah, this is true. I mean, if you take this would be true if it were done in isolation. But if you have all the countries doing the same thing at the same time and playing the same game, there is currency destruction worldwide, and it doesn't really help anyone apart from the one who prints a little bit faster, a little bit sooner. So that is one big issue. The other issue that I think is very important is to realize that the more money that is printed like this, the more the Fed is in a position to manipulate and maintain low interest rates. And these low interest rates are, of course, to the advantage of the government. Because if you took, let's say, $15 trillion of debt, I know not exact numbers, and you had to pay 5% interest, it would be $750 billion that you're paying every year. At the moment, the interest rates are probably averaging somewhere around 2%, and everything that's being issued now is very short term and lower interest rates than that. So it is a very big boon to the governments. Now, the other thing that is a big boon to, of course, are the banks, because the fact that these interest rates are kept low allows them to make very healthy margins on the back of the general public. And we've already been into and discussed a little bit the LIBOR scandal. This is just part of the same package that the banks and the Fed have created for themselves to fleece the general public. Now, I just happened yesterday to be looking at some information on, you know, the distressed real estate that's being sold, where investors are now picking up real estate with 8% yields from people who've been kicked out of their homes legally or otherwise. And of course, the institutions who are financing that are either big private equity funds with their own capital, or they're also using bank financing, which they get at maybe 1-2%. So once again, the objective is to fleece the general public and impoverish them and strip them of their savings through inflation, strip them of their of their wealth through the crash in the real estate market, and then basically sell them into servitude of paying a much higher monthly charge as part of their income to pay the rental, while the institutions that have set up all this problem in the first place are managing to finance themselves on a very low interest rate and provide an extremely attractive return for their investors. Now, what you can say with private equity, if it is private equity firms, is that there is some benefit to the general public because, for example, if you take CalPERS, the Canadian, or CalSTRS, you know, the Californian pension plans, they are putting, say, large slugs of money into this, and then the teachers and public employees are benefiting. But if you take a wider view on it, for everyone who's benefiting, there's someone else who's been on the receiving end of a very, very bad deal.
Well, on that note, you make a very important point at the end of your article on this currency war situation, which is that, of course, the average person out there and the average person listening to this conversation won't be the kind of person sitting in the central banks with the authority to make the decisions about this quantitative easing. There isn't a lot that the general public can do directly affect what's going on at that level, but they can and should be doing things to protect their own individual wealth against this quantitative easing onslaught. So let's talk about that and how people can take the matters into their own hand to help protect their own savings.
Sure. Well, I think the situation, it's a well-known American saying, you can't fight City Hall. And the ultimate City Hall is of course, the Federal Reserve. So these are the rules that are around for the moment. There have been noble attempts by people like Ron Paul to try and investigate the Fed, which have been stonewalled and eventually may well happen. But for the moment, the only thing to do is say, well, these are the rules of the game that we have to play by. And how can one best look after one's interest? Now, if we look at the other consequences of quantitative easing, apart from lowering interest rates and depleting people's wealth, it does have the impact of increasing certain other assets. If you look at the stock market, you'll see every time that there's quantitative easing, the stock market goes up. And as someone very eloquently said, you know, every time the tide goes in, the boats rise, however some rise more than others. So I would say the issue here is look at the asset classes that you happen to be invested in. The stock market is being forced up into another bubble. Real estate, Mr. Bernanke would love to see another bubble develop where the bubble has already burst, which I was never good at physics at school, but that seems to be quite difficult to do. I know you're a physics graduate, so I defer to you.
No. I only took one semester of physics. But even I believe that you're correct about that. It's hard to inflate a popped bubble.
It's hard to inflate. So then we say, all right, the stock market is out. The bond market is waiting to explode as well, because the artificially low interest rates one day will eventually come to an end. Commodities, which have been very popular for a long time, have been on a tear for ages. But if we look now at the slowing down of all the industrial economies in the world, from China, which is always mentioned as a savior, in fact, their consumption of these raw materials are going down. Iron ore prices are going through the floor. Copper prices are going through the floor. So by a process of elimination, you say, all right, where can I actually go to preserve some kind of wealth? And you end up with precious metals, basically. So you have gold and silver. Now, these have been store of value for thousands of years. They've been a monetary payment method for thousands of years. The only person who doesn't think this is the case, of course, is Mr. Ben Bernanke. But Mr. Ben Bernanke is playing a crooked game. Essentially, what he's doing is he is trying to keep people corralled into this situation of believing in paper money, even although it is being destroyed, believing in the stock market, even although it's in a bubble, and the bond market. So he doesn't really have a choice. He works for a cartel which is owned by the banks, and the banks, as we unfortunately know, own the politicians. So the lie will continue until it finally collapses in a great big heap on the ground. Now, in order to maintain this lie, he has to enlist the help of various institutions to make it possible, notably the SEC and the CFTC, which are the supervisory regulatory bodies over everything that happens in the precious metals futures markets. And these people do nothing else but turn a blind eye and deliberately collude with the central banks and the government to suppress the price of gold and silver and pretend this is not happening. Now, there are two ways to look at this. You can say, all right, well, I'm not going to get involved. Or you can say, well, I fully understood that their game is not going to work. And when their game eventually does collapse, and the only safe haven that will remain is gold and silver, and we should be thanking Mr. Bernanke and his cabal of crooks who are working with him today for maintaining an artificially low price in these commodities. Because one day, either they will run out of physical, because people asking for physical at knockdown prices will finally empty all the warehouses of the CME and other place, and perhaps even the central banks. And then gold and silver are going to literally rocket up in price. So, as I say, I don't think, although it's very frustrating to look at an entire financial system that is so corrupt and so destroyed from the inside, one just has to try and pick out the little bits that are interesting. And for me, as you know, as an observer of the situation, I could only believe in gold and silver.
Well, it's quite obvious to anyone who's been watching the markets for any length of time that those precious metals markets have been manipulated for an awfully long time, and it is a question of how long they're able to maintain the illusion. And of course, that does depend on, for example, people not actually claiming physical possession of their gold and silver and relying on stocks, etc., to do the math for them. But once that does start to change, and as you say, as it starts to become apparent that there is a run on the gold and silver market, the upside is going to be pretty extraordinary. I like also what you wrote at the end of this article, again, on GenevaBusinessInsider.blogspot.com. You said, if you wish to preserve your wealth in a world where governments and banks, for their own survival, are determined to inflate it away, steal from you through zero interest rates, high taxes, fraudulent activities, or outright theft, then you must hold real assets, be it land, gold, and silver, art collections, etc., completely outside of the banking system and as far away from government intervention as possible. I don't imagine that needs to be spelled out in too much detail, but perhaps you should explain why it is important to keep it away from the banking system and away from government intervention.
Well, yes. I mean, we're looking at a situation where we have a very small number of too-big-to-fail banks, and it is not all the banks who are completely corrupt. But it is the too-big-to-fail banks, essentially, who are corrupt. And those are the banks that are behind and are investors in the Fed, for example. Now, these people, with half a dozen phone calls around the world, can turn off and on the taps on an awful lot of things. And if one day there's a directive saying, well, tomorrow morning we're going to have a bank holiday, and if you've got your goods stored in Citibank or Bank of America or JP Morgan, to pick my favorite, you can come to their front door and knock on it, and nobody will let you in to give you access to your safety deposit box in the bank. So that is a dangerous issue. The other issue that's a problem, of course, is that if you happen to be in America and you have your goods, you have your gold or precious metals stored again in an institution in their vaults, and there's a regulation that one day says, all right, all of these vaults have now got to be opened, and all these safety deposit boxes opened in front of a notary to see whether you have any physical gold in there, it's very difficult to resist. So for citizens of different countries around the world, the best solution is to make sure that the physical custody of the asset you're holding is not in the hands of a bank who have shown a spectacular lack of integrity towards their clients and free license to do so, basically backed by the government. I mean, I was looking at the Royal Bank yesterday and thinking to myself, essentially what has happened is the politicians don't want to ask for another bailout from the public, so they give the bank free license to fleece and steal from the public and cover for their misdeeds at any time, saying, oh dear, we need to change the regulations. It is a conspiracy to defraud the public. And I think if you look at physical gold and silver and you look at the banks in that light, you would never, ever, ever contemplate leaving your assets with a bank.
Well, exactly.
Question as to whether you should even leave the assets in the country where you live or where you have your nationality. Because frankly, I think that is very dangerous. Because once again, the governments have control over you.
Exactly right. And at the very least, I think diversification is a key strategy, not only in terms of what you are physically holding, but where you are holding it. So it couldn't hurt to have that spread out across different jurisdictions. Exactly right. Well, I understand you're also working on, in your own local situation there, what's happening in Switzerland and the banking and financial sector and the regulations, as you point out, that are being modified as we speak, and how that's affecting things in Switzerland. Perhaps you can tell us a little bit about that.
Sure, yeah. Well, I mean, Switzerland has got two major banks, UBS and Credit Suisse. Both of these banks have been extremely irresponsible in the way they've managed their affairs. They have got heavily involved in the US, UBS more particularly, but also Credit Suisse. And the problem with this is that it's led to the wrath of the American regulators. Now, American regulators have multiple standards. They have none for their own banks, and they have very strong standards for other banks which may have a part of the market or they may perceive as directly or indirectly taking some of the people who should be paying taxes in the US and moving them elsewhere. So Switzerland's a small country. It is easily intimidated. We have at this stage in Switzerland's history, and I am a Swiss citizen and also British, some of the most pathetic politicians we have ever had in control, who do not seem to be able to stand up to anybody, who bend over in awe to the Americans, and worst of all, don't have a strategy. Now, if one has to bend over in awe, that is because one realizes the relative force and one knows what to do about it. But if you do it just as a gut reaction to pressure, then you're not being very smart. So this is the issue for Switzerland, and we are seeing now the major banks where more and more people are saying we need to do our business outside Switzerland. The banking secrecy, which was an absolutely enshrined, in fact, even into the constitution of Switzerland, has more or less been put in the dustbin, and everyone is in free flight. Now, the worst thing that I have seen recently, which concerns me directly, is the involvement. People who've been involved in working with American clients have had their names given to the American government by the banks. Now, I am sworn to banking secrecy with the punishment that if I don't respect banking secrecy, I can even go to prison. But my employers and the country of which I'm a national are perfectly happy to give my name over. So the only thing I can say is I'm very happy I took my kids to Orlando a couple of years ago, and you're certainly not going to get any tourist dollars from me in the near or long-term future. And I think that is the only protest that I can make to the system. But that is one issue. And the other issue, which is making the market shake, is the petroleum industry and the trading business, where Geneva and Zug, two regions in Switzerland, have been particularly strong. And again, the pressures are mounting to have stricter regulations and all the rest of it. And basically what is happening is that the companies who are based here say, well, if you want to decide what our morality should be, we'll decide our own morality, but we'll do it from Singapore, or we'll do it from Hong Kong, or we'll do it from somewhere else around the world. Now, I would love to be the person who could actually change the immorality of the oil business. And, but once again, I mean, we're looking at minor manifestations of it compared to what was done by the Bush regime when they invaded Iraq, or by the European Union when they invaded Libya, or when, if you go back in history, the various histories with Iraq, for example, where the state-owned petroleum company was 90% owned by foreigners, Britain, France, and the US, and 10% owned by the Iraqis. Now that, for example, upset Saddam Hussein, and one can understand why. So it's all just part of a package of hypocrisy where the general public is led to believe one thing's done for one reason, and the reality is quite different.
Well, it is sad to say that the prognosis for the world economy is not good at this point, but again, there are things that people can do to protect their own wealth. So again, I hope they are following Geneva Business Insider at genevabusinessinsider.blogspot.com. And on that note, I understand you've also started posting some videos to your YouTube account. Perhaps you can tell people about that.
Yes, indeed. I was inspired to do so by a certain Mr. James Corbett.
I'm blushing like a maiden.
That's all right. Don't worry at all. Credit where it's due, but you put onto your blog on one occasion, I think, telling people how to do it. And I went out and listened to it and took the advice and started doing some radio and some video. It takes a little bit of while to get comfortable with it, but once you are, I think there's a huge transformation between writing a blog and actually doing a video, having a conversation, listening to real people, and actually having a feeling whether you trust and believe that person, like the color of his eyes or whatever else it might be. So I'm doing that, and I've actually taken there's a young student in a local university who's giving me a few tips on how to present myself, and little by little I hope I'm going to get better at it and people are going to enjoy it more. There's an old saying that says if you pick up a pen, you pick up a sword, but if you pick up a video camera, you pick up at least an Exocet missile and perhaps a nuclear missile, depending on where you manage to target it. And at the end of the day, I mean, the pleasure for me is to be able to communicate to people who are interested and want to understand the bits that I understand and glean from them the parts that, you know, I didn't know, but they can explain clearly to me. And in fact, what is happening with all of this is the mainstream media, I think, for sophisticated listeners, is just going to be completely ignored apart from seeing the football results. And if you want any real meaningful information, you're going to say, all right, well, I'll look at the Geneva Business Insider or a large number of other very articulate, very capable people who who put the situation clearly, simply, and with honesty and with no conflict of interest, because I have no conflict of interest in telling the truth, and that has become a rarity.
Unfortunately so, but as you say, that's in the mainstream paradigm, but of course we are moving into a different paradigm where it's more of a conversation and less of some one-way directed information spout coming from directly from the corporate Borg. So it is for the better. Of course, there's a lot of wrong information and misinformation and people who are trying their best but getting a lot of things wrong. So there's a lot of bad with the good, but I think that that's something that we will have to sort out for ourselves, and I think we have to be responsible adults in terms of starting to source our own information. So I always am glad to see more people taking up the mantle and starting to get into the conversation rather than watching from the sidelines. So I'm happy to link to that. For people who are watching this YouTube video, I will put an annotation in so you can just click on that annotation to go to his YouTube channel, David Smith's YouTube channel. But for the people who are listening to this or watching through some other medium, perhaps you can just tell them the name of that channel.
My video channel is Geneva Business Inside.
Inside, okay.
Inside.
All right.
Not enough room for the last letter, but Geneva Business Inside.
Okay, so youtube.com/GenevaBusinessInside. Of course, that's also linked up from GenevaBusinessInsider.blogspot.com, and all of that will be linked up in the show notes for this interview. So lots of different ways to get there, but however you get there, I hope you are tuned in and watching some of this commentary and reading it on the blog. So David L. Smith, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you again for joining us today.
It's been great. Thank you very much once again. Okay, speak to you soon.
The Corbett Report is brought to you by you. Your support makes The Corbett Report possible. Sign up for the subscriber newsletter or purchase a DVD at corbettreport.com/support.